And there was much rejoicing.
Metcast, Sunday, January 16th, 2011. Hey, MacGeeks, it's time for your Metcast, the show for MacGeeks by MacGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome to the Maccast. What a week it has been. Yeah, the opening, you can probably guess, of this episode is an homage, a homage, a homily. No, that's not right. An honorarium of the ending of an era, actually a multi-year era, meaning that we can no longer talk about the rumored Verizon iPhone. We have to talk about the Verizon iPhone. It happened early this week on Tuesday. The big, big announcement that many of us, you, we have been waiting for. The Verizon iPhone. And we're going to have all the details in this episode, along with a bunch of other stuff. But before we dive into that, I do want to take a quick moment, thank one of my show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You know, I'm getting ready to do my taxes. I don't know about you. It's not my favorite time of year, but it's something that we all have to go through. I have a bunch of things that I need to do, documents and stuff that I need to pull together. And it's for stuff like this that I find Notebook comes in as a really handy thing to have in my application arsenal. I launch up Notebook, I can start up a tax notebook, I can start dividing out different sections, different categories. I have a business that I run, you know, through the Maccast, I have to do business stuff, and there's certain documents and things like that that my tax person wants to see when I go in to meet with her. So I will go through, I'll pull that research together. It's great because I can dump in PDFs, I can grab stuff from websites, I can make web clippings, I can throw that in there, I can get my receipts together, I scan a lot of that stuff in so I can have the scans right there and start to organize it and pull together. Not only that, I can use the lists to set up to-dos with check marks so that I know what I have done, what I still have left to do, and I can keep it all in one place. And now, since they've released the iPad version of Notebook, I will be able to sync all of that, sync my notebook over to my iPad and bring that with me to my tax meeting, have it right there, everything together in one place, all organized, all indexed, and I think it's going to really help me out this year. And that's just one of the great ways you can use Notebook and how it can fit into your Mac lifestyle. So you can check it out. You can get more information and details on their website, circusponies.com. They have the desktop app and now the new iPad app. Check it out. And a big thank you to Circus Ponies for their support of the show. So it's here. The wait is over. The Verizon iPhone. You're going to be able to pick yours up on February 10th. That's when they go on sale. I believe they announced that they're doing pre-orders to existing Verizon customers starting on the 3rd of February, but the actual ship date of the phone is February 10th, so if you want to get that. I know a lot of you have been waiting for it to come to Verizon just because of network things, and I think what AT&T and Verizon are both going to find out is that as cool as the phones are in terms of technology, both on the Android side and the Apple side, and even some of the new Windows phones are getting some good press here and there, is that ultimately people want phones that also they have to work, right? And that's what this has all come down to. And the AT&T exclusivity ending, as you're going to hear in a minute, there are going to be a lot of people who are going to be switching. But as far as the phone itself goes, it is the same phone. There isn't a new Verizon phone. There had been some rumors that maybe we might see a new or some updates to the existing iPhone 4 design. Really not much changed as far as the insides go, other than adding the CDMA chipset. And reportedly, Apple and Verizon had been kind of coming to, in order to get the agreement to happen, what had really taken the time was not doing the deal as much as the technology and figuring out the technology. Apple didn't want to change anything in the design of the iPhone 4 to accommodate extra CDMA stuff. So at least officially, according to Apple and Verizon, that's why they're saying it took so long to get the iPhone on Verizon. But that I have a feeling there was some inner dealings and some back and forth. Many people have noted that the Apple logo is the only logo on the back of the Verizon iPhone 4, and typically Verizon does require that their logo is on the back of most of the phones that they sell, and also they very often include their own applications. I guess they call that side loading. I had never really heard that term before, but loading additional software or applications that are exclusive to just Verizon on the phones themselves, or modifying or changing features, which is one of the reasons why I left Verizon. I had a Razor way back in the day, and so many of the features were disabled by Verizon in the firmware that it just made the phone not as usable as it should be, and that's why I moved over to AT&T with the iPhone. And I'm actually going to be staying there. A lot of people are asking me, are you going to stay with AT&T? Well, yeah, because I left Verizon for a number of reasons, and AT&T coverage where I live isn't bad, but I totally get that if you have bad AT&T coverage, you're in a similar situation, right? Because if you can't get on the network, you can't use your phone. So it doesn't even matter if you have access to all the features, you're not able to use them. So on some of the other specs that have changed, or other things that have changed, the only real aesthetic change is the moving of those antenna gaps. We saw some of the leaked pictures. There are now four little antenna gaps, and they are on each side. So you have two on the left side, two on the right side. That is a design change from the AT&T iPhone 4. Other than that, everything else is the same. They did not give us any details on pricing or data plans on the Verizon network, other than to point out that they are going to support the hotspot feature, which will let you use your iPhone as a mobile hotspot for up to five other devices over Wi-Fi, so to get on the 3G network. Oh, and it is on the 3G network, no 4G LTE. As to why Apple moved those antenna gaps, there seems to be a lot of debate going on about that right now. You know, if you ask me, they changed the design. It's likely to deal with just some of the issues that a lot of us experienced. Whether or not, you know, we kind of want to go back and relive AntennaGate, but whether or not there was an issue or not an issue, I've never really been impacted by it. I certainly can see the behavior on my phone, and it'll be interesting to see when the Verizon iPhone comes out if it doesn't suffer those same issues. Some of the people that actually have had some hands-on time with it have already reported that it doesn't seem to suffer those issues. And if you remember Spencer Webb from Antennasys, he did a lot of the original analysis on the iPhone 4 when it came out, and did a lot of the explanation of an investigation as to why the death grip, quote-unquote death grip issue was existing. He is saying that he really feels the design change was to deal with the antenna issues. Several sites, though, have also pointed out that it might just be that CDMA networks, specifically Verizon, requires that there are two antenna points on their phone designs, a top and a bottom, usually. So by having that on the side, the idea is that Apple maybe moved those antennas, the cellular receiving antennas, to the top and bottom of the phone. So you have two antennas on the Verizon iPhone 4, and then the Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, and GPS antennas are now internal to the phone and on the inside. And if you remember when we saw that leaked mid-plate image, there was a gap, an internal gap, just above the home button. And it looked like an antenna might go in that location too. So maybe that's where Apple moved the Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, and GPS antennas to. I guess we'll have to find out when the phone is released and people start taking it apart. So when iFixit gets a hold of it, I bet you we're going to find out a lot about how Apple changed around the internal design, but externally not looking too different. And reports are coming out now too that AT&T obviously hasn't made any fans with their network. If you remember, a lot of us switched to AT&T, maybe you did yourself, just to get the iPhone. I seem to remember the numbers being somewhere around like 30% way back in the day, that about 30% of new iPhone purchasers were new to the AT&T network. Well, all those people might be moving back, because in December, this was before the announcement was even made, ChangeWave did a survey, and they found that 16% of AT&T customers said they would move to Verizon if they got the iPhone on the network. And 26% of people who already owned an iPhone on the AT&T network said they would switch if Verizon got the iPhone. So that's about that 30% of iPhone owners on AT&T are already to switch, and they're going to do it pretty quick, according to the ChangeWave survey as well, because they say that 41% of those 26% will switch in the first 3 months. So as soon as that iPhone hits, they're going to go. Now, I don't know if the new early termination fees are going to make any difference. I think it costs about $325, if I'm remembering right, to break your contract on AT&T. That's a pretty stiff price. But I mean, if you can't make phone calls, that might be worth it. So I'd be curious to find out if you're going to be switching now that it's on Verizon, or if you haven't picked up an iPhone before, if you've been waiting for it to come on Verizon, are you going now? Are you going to get the new V phone? You're going to get it right away, too, because it might have a short lifespan. Apple's typical iPhone upgrade cycle, we're expecting the iPhone 5 in June. No word on whether or not Apple will upgrade it for both AT&T and Verizon. Are they going to move to different schedules? It doesn't seem likely to me. If I were a betting man, I'm going to guess, and Apple and Verizon sort of said at the event that they really just wanted to get this phone into the hands of Verizon customers because they've been demanding it, they've been asking it, which is why we haven't seen a new design. We don't see LTE. And honestly, I don't think we're going to see LTE this year. They were asked about it at the event, and they didn't make any specific comment on it. I just don't think the 4G LTE networks are going to be in wide enough circulation. The only caveat to that I'll give is that if Apple has come up with a chipset that can be upgraded or can do both the 3G, 4G, CDMA, you know, all of the basebands and all of the networks that they need to do, then possibly the iPhone 5 will have that technology in it, but I don't think they're going to make a special version just for the LTE networks when those networks aren't available in wide rollout and really aren't expected to be widely deployed until, you know, 2013, I think, is when the build-outs are going to be complete. So I could see it coming out in 2012, and that brings up an interesting thought that I've been having too, is are we not going to see an iPhone 5 in June? Is Apple going to shift their release cycle to early in the year and get it in line with when they're releasing the Verizon phone? I don't think they're going to do that either, because I think they like having the dates spread out, and typically now April is that time frame when we see upgraded iPads, or that's the speculation at the moment. So it's going to be interesting to see what Apple does. I don't think that they can put out a new iPhone 5 with LTE in June, though. I think the networks just aren't ready for it, and I think they could do it in January. So do we shift it? Do we not? I'm really up in the air on this one. I don't think they're going to. Here's what I think is going to happen. I think we're going to have the iPhone 4 in February on the Verizon network. Then we're going to see an upgrade to both the phones for Verizon and AT&T in June. And I think you're going to have a lot of really upset. There's going to be a backlash and outcry from Verizon customers who bought a phone in February and are now locked into a contract for 2 years and can't switch. They're going to have to wait all the way a whole nother year and possibly want to wait a year and a half so they get back on that June release cycle in 2012. Might make sense, though, because I think I've been hearing that there's now a 20-month contract upgrade change, that you can't upgrade your phone on the Verizon network till you're in the 20th month of your two-year contract. So I'd have to work out those dates to see how those line up, but those might line up perfectly. But I think you're still going to have people who are upset that they got the iPhone 4 in February and there's a new iPhone 5 for them to buy in June that they can't buy without breaking their contract or paying full price. Either way, it's going to be a really fun summer. It's also going to be really fun to see what happens with AT&T and Verizon customers. And I think ultimately, in the end, we're going to win, because I think the two are going to play off of each other. I'm hoping that there were rumors Verizon was going to do unlimited data plans. If Verizon does unlimited data plans, I think AT&T is going to have to go back to them to keep up. And if you remember, they took those away from us in a recent update. So very exciting times. If you want to know how I feel ultimately about the Verizon iPhone coming out, I've been waiting for it. I never thought it would happen, honestly. I'm glad it's here now, and I think that we're going to see more carrier networks open up, although Apple and Verizon did say there's some sort of, not exclusive agreement, it's not exclusive, but they're in partnership, close partnership, I think is somewhat how they described it. So I think it might be 6 months or a couple months before we see it on T-Mobile and Sprint and other networks, but I think Apple is going to open up the iPhone globally on multiple carriers. I think that's been their plan all along. And it's nice that we finally are taking now those first steps to see that happen. And I think ultimately we as consumers are going to win, because I think the companies are going to have to compete, and competition is always a good thing. So what about those new devices? What about the new iPad, new iPhone? Rumors are now heating up. Now that we've gotten past the Verizon thing, we can focus on that. It's going to be interesting to see what that... I'm a little bit sad, I have to admit, on the Verizon thing, because I don't have that rumor now that I can just keep reusing for 3 years. I need a new one. What's that new one going to be? I don't think it's going to be iPad 2 and iPhone rumors. Those are just going to be always ongoing, but I think we're on those release cycles. So as far as what's happening with the new iPhone, iPad, iPad 2, iPhone, sounds like both of them are going to get a new CPU. According to Engadget, it's going to be named the A8, and based on an ARM Cortex A9 design, which has the ability to be a dual core processor. There are also single core versions of the A9. A dual core would require more power, offer a lot more performance, and multi-threading, which could be very interesting on an iOS device. But is Apple going to go with that trade-off? They're building their custom silicone, so they could do anything. But definitely, we're going to see a new graphics processor. I didn't hear anything on the speed of the processor. I would imagine we would see a bump up to at least like 1.2 gigahertz from the 1 gigahertz Cortex A4 that's happening right now, although it may stay the same if they go with the dual core. It could be 1 gigahertz dual core design. Don't really know. On the graphics side, it looks like we're also due for an update in the GPU. Apple might move to the new PowerVR SGX 543 chip from Imagination Technologies. They've been using the Imagination Technologies chipsets for a while now. And what happened this week is Apple released iOS 4.3 beta to developers, and the driver bundles show references to a new PowerVR chipset. Apple, in 2009, did up their holdings, their investment in Imagination Technologies, to 9%. So they have been working with the company closely. They have a significant investment in the company, so we would expect them to continue to use the latest and greatest chipsets from them. In the A4 chip, the current chip that's in the iPhone 4, and even on the older iPhone 3GS, they were using a PowerVR SGX 535 GPU. What's the big deal about the new chipset is that they support OpenCL, which is a technology Apple has put its operating system behind. If you remember, that was something that was added, I believe, in Leopard, and has continued in Snow Leopard. And the new chip from Imagination Technologies could allow, I think one quote said, 1080p HD video to flow like water out of the chipset, out of the stream, should we say. I guess that's a good analogy, right? But 1080p HD video on an iPhone, on an iPad. Let's hope if Apple does that, they give us a really good way to get an HDMI out, either through the dock connector or built in. My guess is it's going to be through a dock adapter. I think there's adapters even out right now for the current generation iPads and iPhones. So we're looking at new CPUs, new GPUs. What about the wireless baseband? Well, we now know in the States that Apple's going to be supporting CDMA networks. Also, just globally, I think China, Japan also have significant percentages of their population that are covered by CDMA technologies. So rumor is that Apple may be moving away from the current baseband chipsets that they're using and switch over to a Qualcomm chipset that will enable them to do GSM and CDMA in the same chip. I think we've been talking about that rumor for a while now. That seems the next logical step, and so I would imagine we'll get an upgrade on the baseband chips also. So those things, new CPU, GPU, and the baseband, we would expect to happen to both the iPhone and the iPad. Rumors are heating up on the iPad too, because I think we're getting close to an announcement and a release date. Everybody's expecting a higher resolution display, not retina resolution, not the 326 pixels per inch retina pixel density, but definitely an upping of the resolution, probably quadrupling is the latest rumors, to 2048 pixels by 1536 pixels, which if you do the math, works out to about a 260 pixels per inch pixel density. So very high res. And one of the ways that this rumor is manifesting itself is that a new version of the iBooks app is in the, I think, the iOS 4.3 beta, and it's showing these higher resolution graphics at that 1536 pixel width. So everybody's expecting that to be the new resolution that's supported on the iPad 2. Bigger speaker for a little bit better audio. We've been hearing about that for a while and seeing some case designs that would support that. Front and rear facing cameras. I'm starting to believe this one now. I thought it was only going to be a front facing camera, but with the other tablets that are coming on the market all having rear facing cameras, I think Apple's going to add it in there. I just don't know how much utility I would get out of a rear facing iPad camera. I don't see myself holding up my iPad and snapping a whole lot of pictures, but I guess there's people out there that might want to do that. Definitely the forward-facing camera for FaceTime. That's really going to open up the FaceTime network. And, man, you're going to have a lot of people that you can call and see. I still don't know if that's something I want to do a whole bunch. But with more people getting the devices, it's more people that I can potentially call or not call, as the case may be. I would expect also that we're going to get upgraded RAM, at least up to 256 megabytes, but that's just my own personal speculation. Another thing that has been rumored recently is that it will get an SD card slot built into it, so you won't have to use Apple's camera connection kit. I think a lot of people really bought that kit, so Apple sees the value in that, and I think that is a nice logical upgrade. We've seen the SD card being added to Apple's notebook line, and I think it makes sense for it to be in the iPad for transferring photos and things like that. It's just easier to pop that out of your camera and plug it right into your device to transfer your photos and your videos and things like that. And I think it's going to make the iPad more of a device that can start to be used for content creation and editing and things like that. iMovie, hopefully, if it'll come to the iPad, would be really great to be able to take your SD card out of your digital video camera, pop that into your iPad, and start editing video to share. Could be a really neat thing to see. And then the design, we're still hearing the kind of the same design changes, that it'll have an absolutely flat back, tapered edges, just slightly thinner on the design, and maybe a slightly thinner bezel on the front. We were talking on the We Have Communicators podcast, and Michael Johnston mentioned that he didn't think that necessarily was a good thing to have a thinner outside bezel. And I tend to agree, because that's kind of where I grab at mine. And the current bezel is about the width of my thumb, just about the right width. And if it was a little bit narrower when I was holding it, I'd be covering up the screen a little bit with my thumb. And I don't necessarily like that. So good news is it's sounding like we're not going to have long to wait to find out the exact specifications. A couple of the rumor sites are reporting that we should see a release date around April 2nd or 9th. So just a few weeks away. And I'm excited to see the new iPad 2. It's going to be interesting to see how Apple ups the game. I think they have a big lead in the tablet space, and I think the iPad 2 is going to take it to the next level, and everybody's going to still be playing catch-up, at least for the next year. Some of the new tablets that are coming out from competitors, there are only, you know, one or two that are really getting any good reviews. I know we're waiting on Android's new operating system for the tablets called, I think, Honeycomb. A lot of that was being shown off at CES, although a lot of the reviews I was hearing out of there weren't that positive, mainly because the Honeycomb OS wasn't ready for prime time. It's not going to be really ready, I think, until the midsummer, and Apple just is going to have a jump on everybody again. So I would imagine 2012, just like the iPhone, it seems like we're repeating the iPhone process, where the competitors really didn't start to catch up until about the third year of the device. They're about 3 years behind, and it's seeming to track that way with the iPad. Again, I like competition, though. So the more people keep putting pressure on Apple, the better it is for us and the better it is for the iPad. So I'd like to see it happen sooner or later, although I really don't think that's going to be the case. Betcha the Beatles are wondering why they waited so long to get their music out digitally on iTunes right about now. This week, the Loop reported that the iTunes store recently exceeded 5 million downloads on Beatles songs and has sold over 1 million Beatles albums worldwide. The Beatles music went on sale November 16th, I think it was, 2010, and about a week later, they had announced they had sold about 2 million songs and had 450,000 album downloads. So things have slowed down a little bit, but man, that seems like a lot of numbers. The iTunes deal for Beatles tracks is said to be exclusive, Although Apple and Apple Corps, the Beatles record label, I guess that is, have not confirmed when that exclusivity ends. Apple will only say that it is expiring in 2011. So early 2011, mid, we don't know. But as long as they keep selling music, it sounds like they're going to be doing a pretty good deal. There were some recent rumors that said that in order to get the Beatles music on iTunes, Apple had to pay digital royalties directly to the Beatles, which is a little bit different than it normally works. Normally, the royalties are paid out, I guess, to the record label, and then the record label distributes them to both the publisher and the artist. And I guess under this deal, with Apple paying them directly, the Beatles stand to get a little bit more money than they would under the other agreement. And that was what it took to kind of make the deal happen. And just in case you're curious, the top-selling album is Abbey Road, and the top-selling track is Here Comes the Sun. And if my memory serves me right, I think that's exactly what it was when they announced they had hit the 2 million mark after launching on iTunes. I don't find the album so surprising. I'm kind of curious about the track. I'm not a huge Beatles fan, so maybe you can maybe you can inform me. But I didn't know that that was that popular a song. The one thing that I remember is I've seen some movies recently, particularly I think kids' movies. B-Movie is the one that most recently comes to mind that feature that track. So I'm wondering if the popularity is more due to its recent appearance in some popular films and things like that. But weigh in with your opinions if you have any thoughts on that. Something that didn't happen this week that I was a little disappointed about was the announcement from Apple and Rupert Murdoch and News Corp that they had the Daily app available, which was going to be a daily newspaper periodical style app coming to the iPad. And I think one of the promises of the iPad was that it was going to help revolutionize or change the publishing industry with respect to periodicals, newspapers, and magazines and stuff like that. And I think we've seen some interesting things. Wired's done a pretty good job with their app, and most recently Virgin Publishing with their Project magazine application. And the thing that's holding all that stuff back is a true subscription payment model, a way for publishers to actually sell subscriptions on the iPad that work like subscriptions, like magazine or newspaper subscriptions. And the one thing that I really want is some ability for, if I buy the print version of a magazine, that I can also get the digital version. I'm willing to pay more. You know, if I pay X percentage more per month, can I get it both digitally and the print version? And I think that is something that needs to happen. We haven't seen that happen. So there was supposed to be this big announcement about the Daily. It reportedly has been delayed now. We're not really sure why, other than the speculation is that there's been some technical issues that the engineers still need to work on. And then kind of adding insult to injury with that delay and not getting more information about a publishing subscription model. There's rumors coming out that Apple has been fighting a lot of the publishers in Europe over not being able to offer digital subscriptions for free on the iPad on top to just their paid print subscribers. So I'm not sure the specifics of what that hang-up is. It sounds like, or the hope is, that maybe it's just Apple needing to get their ducks in a row internally with the App Store sales and the in-app purchase to make subscriptions and basically the free subscriptions to paid subscribers happen, but under Apple's terms and sort of fitting into Apple's models. And it sounds like there might be some technical things that they still need to work through. But hopefully we'll hear an announcement on that in the near future, because I'm looking forward to that actually happening. Because I think at that point, that's when things get revolutionized with the iPad with respect to magazines and newspapers. And with the release of the iPad 2 right around the corner, I would expect that we would see a new version of iOS to go along with that. And Apple did release this week iOS 4.3 Beta 1 to developers for testing. It's been downloaded, and a lot of reported features and rumors and speculation are starting to come out of that release. Probably the biggest thing in the update that was immediately announced was new multi-touch gestures for the iPad, three-finger and four-finger gestures, mainly for doing things like quick switching between applications. So you're able to swipe with three or four fingers and move between your open applications without having to go double tap the home button and scroll through the list, switch back and forth. So it makes fast app switching much more usable. So I'm looking forward to that part of the update. Something that's going to disappoint some of you is apparently there's no more support for the iPhone 3G or the iPod Touch 2G, with iOS 4.2, at least the first beta build. Who knows if that will continue, if that means the end of iOS updates for those devices. GSM phones are actually going to get the personal hotspot feature. At least it's in the beta of 4.3. That could mean that AT&T is going to have personal hotspot available. It might just be a change of the language, though. Tethering is available, and that has, been replaced in the iOS 4.3 beta with language that says personal hotspot. So I don't know if Apple's worked out those details or deals with AT&T, but feature is showing up in the next version of iOS. FaceTime has a new icon, and I have to tell you, I think it's ugly. I looked at it. It's terrible. I really, really don't like it. Maybe I'll get used to it. I don't know. But it's kind of a silver icon. It has a recessed background that just has a weird texture to it. And then it's got the little, it's got the camera icon, the FaceTime camera icon that we've seen on the desktop application. But then it has the lens icon that is in the middle that looks like the lens icon in the photo app. And it's just like, it's too busy. There's too much going on and it's just too small. I don't know. I don't like it, but weigh in with your opinion if you disagree with me. iAds can now be displayed full screen. That makes sense since we have iAds coming to the iPad very soon. So you're going to want to be able to blow those up and have a full experience. And I'm sure the publishers of ads want to be able to take advantage of the full screen real estate on the devices. Big news. This one is a welcome addition. So, you know, Apple's been bouncing back and forth with the physical, whether you want to call it the mute switch, the silencer switch, or the screen lock switch, depending on which device you're talking about. But if you remember, the iPhone, the physical switch was always to mute the sound, to turn off the sound and put it into silent mode. When the iPad was originally released, it has a physical switch as well, but that was a screen rotation lock. With the latest update, iOS 4.2, Apple changed the physical button on the iPad to be a mute switch, just like on the iPhone, and then moved the rotation lock into the multitasking bar. So if you swipe to the right, you get the rotation lock, but it's all in software. Now we're actually going to have the ability with 4.3 to tell the device what we want it to be. We can have it be a mute switch, we can have it be a rotation lock, and it's from the settings. The way it should have been all along, finally we're going to get that with the 4.3 update. That might be, to me, more exciting than the new multi-touch gestures. I don't know. Those two are ranking up there as my favorite new features. There's new message alerts settings and also a new font in the notes. Actually, they're removing one of the fonts. There was a font for notes called Chalkboard. That's going away. It's being replaced by a font called Noteworthy. And you now can control some of the settings for your SMS alerts and your push notification alert settings. So you can have those things remind you multiple times, more than just, I think, two or three times is the default right now. If you ignore those messages, you know, it beeps at you again. You can turn that off completely. You can control that. So you're able to fine tune that stuff from the settings. And then there's an update to AirPlay that's going to allow you to stream AirPlay stream to an Apple TV to some web video encoded in H.264. Apparently not all web videos, so it's dependent upon the publisher. When you publish the video, I guess there's a settings switch that they can actually set to say whether or not it's able to be streamed via AirPlay. Consensus is that that feature is in there, that sort of lock is in there, so that certain publishers, I would assume movie and TV studios, can actually block the feature and not allow you to stream the web video from their web pages to your Apple TV 2. That's the kind of thing that just irks me. You know, if I can watch it on my desktop or my notebook, why can't I send it over to a TV? So hopefully not too many publishers take advantage of that feature, but it is rumored to be in there. So that's a lot of the outward-facing features and things that people have discovered. They're also rooting around, as they do, in the low-level system files, preference lists, and bundles, and things like that, and they're discovering other things. There's rumors of an updated camera app, possibly with support for iPad. We're seeing larger graphics for the camera app, which would make sense on an iPad screen. That would presumably go along with the new forward and rear-facing cameras that are rumored to be in that device. Photo booth might be coming to iOS. I think that's a great addition and would be a lot of fun. Now that we have forward-facing cameras for FaceTime, why not have photo booth and photo booth style effects for doing our FaceTime video chats like we have in iChat. So I think we're going to be seeing some updates. Who knows if it'll be actual a separate photo booth application or something that you take advantage of through just the built-in camera app and the FaceTime application. Support for more more powerful graphics processors. That would go along with the rumor about getting some new GPU chipsets. There is reportedly something referencing a Find My Friends feature. The assumption there would be that would work like Find My iPhone or My iPad through your Mobile Me account, but you'd be able to open that up and let your friends see where you are. Of course, if you give permission for them to see that. And I find that rumor interesting because, you know, Apple did open up the Find My iPhone, iPad, Find My iPad feature to anybody with an Apple ID. You don't need to have an actual Mobile Me account anymore. So possibly they could be trying to get into that social space where like Google Latitude or Foursquare and Twitter with location features and stuff like that have built in. Apple can enable that and get more people using their iTunes accounts and their Apple IDs for doing that kind of functionality. So that does kind of make sense to see that in there. And then a big rumor that I'm not really buying is with these new four-finger swipe and three-finger swipe gestures that Apple may be prepping iOS to have the home button go away. Because if you don't have to double tap the home button to switch between applications, what do you really need the home button for anymore? I think there's a swipe up feature that brings you back to the home screen. So with these gestures, you wouldn't have to have the home button, but I have a feeling Apple might have other ideas for how to use the home button. I think everybody's gotten comfortable and used to that user interface element. I like having it there. I don't know, just something comforting about the home button. I'd hate to see it go away, but competitive tablets, a lot of them don't have physical buttons, and we know that Steve Jobs is rumored to really hate physical buttons, so maybe he wants that to go away. It's nice and subtle now though, Steve. I mean, you hardly notice it. It doesn't detract too much. Don't take my button away, I guess is what I'm saying. I don't know. I don't want to see it go away, but it could, and that's the last rumor coming out from the iOS 4.3 update. And with that, that's it for the news for this week. You know, I got a lot of great feedback from you. I've been talking about Time Machine and backups and things like that. And last week, I talked about Time Machine and network-attached storage devices. And I had said that Time Machine didn't really work with network-attached storage devices. Well, John pointed out to me that he is actually using a NAS product, and it works just fine with his two Macs and Time Machine. The product he has is from a company called Synology. The specific model is the DS209, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes. And I checked it out, and he's absolutely right. It has a web configuration, a web interface that you can configure the device with, as a lot of these do. And there's just a simple checkbox that you can check on and say, I want to use this device with Time Machine. Now, I did, based on John's email, kind of do some investigation into this. And I think where my confusion came into play, and I think a lot of us are probably confused about this, is that there are a lot of network attached storage products out there that claim to be Time Machine compatible. So the stuff from Synology, there's another company called QNAP, and also Drobo has some support for it on specific models. So I wasn't 100% correct, but I think my confusion came into play because last time I did the research on this, Apple doesn't officially support any network attached storage device with Time Machine other than their Time Capsule. So the companies that are enabling this feature are doing it on their own without any support for Apple. And I would assume it could break with an OS update. Things could change. It's still a little bit tricky to navigate around. So if you are getting one of these devices, I would encourage you read through all the documentation on the company's website, figure out what the limitations are, how you set it up. And just for example, when I started looking into it, some of the things I noticed is that in all cases, you need to enable the Apple file sharing protocol on the network attached storage device. So not all of them have that. And I would assume that's the ones that say they're Time Machine compatible. They've built in functionality for Apple file sharing protocol. I also noticed that typically you need to either format the whole device or at least what most of them call one share on the device, which I'm assuming is just a disk image, probably like a sparse bundle disk image. as HFS Plus. So it needs to be in an Apple format. And if you do that, if you're in a mixed environment with Mac and Windows, your Windows machines aren't going to be able to access that network attached storage or use it because it's going to be in an Apple file format, at least not without installing some additional software support on the PC to be able to read and write to HFS Plus formatted volumes. So something to note there. Also, I noticed a number of them only allowed one Time Machine Apple file sharing protocol share. So if you're using it with multiple Macs, you know, you're going to have one or two or three Macs backing up to the same Time Machine share. When you divide up your network attached storage volume, make sure you allocate enough space to that one share for all of your Macs to back up to. Because in most cases, you can't sort of resize that or make it bigger or larger without completely destroying it and starting over, which means you're going to lose all the backups for all of your Macs. Again, all of the developers seem to have different specifications and restrictions, so you're going to have to look through each one for each one's specifications for the product that you're looking at. And Apple, again, doesn't officially support this stuff. So buyer beware, but it does work. You can get it to work. And I think I also mentioned that you can, there are hacks that you can do to get network attached storage to work with Time Machine. It's just not Apple's recommended way, so I generally just avoid it, but not because it's not technically possible or really hard to do. I don't want to give that impression, but I learned a long time ago, when I start deviating from Apple's recommended way of doing things, I tend to get myself in trouble. So it's more for self-preservation than anything else. And so I just want to, when I offer up solutions that are maybe outside the realm of what Apple supports, I want to caution people and say, yes, it's possible. Just know what you're getting in for. You might have to do some extra troubleshooting. And if you call up Apple and ask for help, they might give you the story of, well, we really can't help you on that one. But a lot of these technologies are supported well by the company. If you go on Drobo's website, and I was checking on the Synology site, they have a lot of great FAQs and how-tos and tips on how to set this all up and how to not get yourself in trouble. But you have to do some reading, you have to do some research, and you have to set it up properly. And I'm assuming that's what John's done, because he says it's been working flawlessly for him, for both his Macs, and he really enjoys the solution. So hopefully I didn't give the wrong impression on that. And thanks, John, for letting me know that it does actually work on some devices. And I realized as I was reading through John's email and kind of prepping the show that it's been a while since I talked to you about how I specifically set up my Time Machine backup, and I thought some of you might find that useful. So just go through the simple process. The very first thing that I do is just picking a hard drive or selecting a hard drive for Time Machine. And my general rule of thumb, and I've had some debate on this, some people say 2 times, some people say 3 times, but my general rule of thumb when I'm looking for a Time Machine backup drive is I take the Mac that I'm going to be backing up, and I don't do any of the network attached storage stuff. I don't have a time capsule, so you'll have to adjust these instructions for that kind of setup if you're going to do it. But I attach a drive to my Mac, and I typically go with USB. USB 2 is fine. It doesn't have to be fast. It's just a backup that's happening. It's just copying some files, and beyond the first time it backs up when it needs to do the full backup, it's really only backing up incremental files, changed files, so you're not pushing a lot of data across that. You can use FireWire, you can use any interface you want, obviously, but you don't need anything more than a USB 2, and also you don't need a super fast drive. 5400 RPM is fine. I usually get desktop hard drive, external hard drives, because I'm not going to be moving my Time Machine backups around. I don't take them with me on the road. So 7200 RPM desktop drive. And I do 2 to 3 times the size of the hard drive that I want to back up. So in my case, my MacBook Pro has a 250 megabyte hard drive. So I get at least a 250 gigabyte hard drive. And I get at least a 500 gig external. Although now I'm going to move to, probably next time I'll move to probably a 1 terabyte. So that's 4 times. And all the only difference that it makes is in terms of how far back in time you're going to be able to go to recover files. Because the big advantage of Time Machine for me over other types of backup is that it's incremental, and I can go back and get changes to files, or if I accidentally delete a file, I can go back and recover that. Whereas with my super duper clone, that's re-imaged every night. So every night it becomes an exact mirror copy of what's on my hard drive at that moment. So you lose any ability to go back and get an old version of a file, or if you accidentally delete, if I delete a file today and then tomorrow I'm working and I go, where's that file? Oh, I deleted it. I can hit Time Machine, I can go right back to it. And if it's a file from 2 years ago, I'm not going to be able to get back that, go back necessarily and get that if I don't have enough storage to keep that in place. Because what Time Machine does is it gives priority to your most recent or newer files. So as it goes back in time, when it starts to need more space, when you filled up that drive and it doesn't have any more space left, it's going to start to drop off versions of those old files or those files that you deleted 2 years ago. It's going to go, well, you didn't need that for the past 2 years. You never put it back. If you put it back, then it would start backing up again and it would be in the newer updates, right? But it will let it just fall off to make more space for the newer files, new emails and photos and things like that that you're adding to your Mac. So the larger the disk that you have, the farther back in time that you're going to be able to go. And that's just how Time Machine works. So at least 2 times the size of your internal drive, 3-4 times as big as you want for as far back in time as you think you're going to want to go. And once you've picked your hard drive, then you hook it up and Time Machine is going to do its thing. It's going to say, do you want to set this up as a Time Machine drive? You say yes. It's going to format it and get it all ready. And then it's going to start doing its thing. And it's going to take a while. So the first time you hook it up, you might want to hook it up at night before you go to bed, leave it running overnight, and it's going to copy all those files onto the Time Machine backup drive. And you can put other files and folders on the Time Machine backup. It basically creates this folder called backups.backupdb. I'm assuming DB means kind of like database. And then it's going to have all of your files and all the incrementals and everything are going to be put into that folder. And that's at the root of the drive. And you can put other stuff at the root of the drive, but keep in mind, as you use up space, you're taking up space that Time Machine has available. So I'd like to have just a dedicated Time Machine drive, but that's just me personally. You don't have to do that. Some people actually partition, will get like a big drive, like a terabyte drive. And if they only need 500 gigabytes for Time Machine, you partition it. You can partition it. You don't have to partition it. You know, your results may vary. I'm just going to tell you what I do. So I get a dedicated Time Machine drive. I hook it up. I set it up. Time Machine's running. I let it do its thing. But not 100% completely, because I don't necessarily need everything on my Mac backed up in my Time Machine backup. So the reason I can get away kind of with just 2 times the size of my internal drive is I don't let it back up everything. I actually do an assessment and decide, okay, what kinds of things can I actually replace? I can put back on my Mac without having to go to Time Machine. Or what kinds of files am I not going to be modifying and changing and deleting and stuff like that? So the system, I don't need it to back up all of the system files and things like that. I also don't need it to back up every single one of my external drives. I certainly don't need it to back up my super duper clone drive that's attached to my Mac, because that gets copied every night, the files change, and Time Machine will back that up. Time Machine will back up any drive that is physically connected to your Mac. So it not only by default does the internal drive, it also does those external drives. I also have some things in my media folder that I don't need it to back up. I don't need it to back up my iTunes podcasts. I subscribe to video podcasts. Those take up, you know, a significant amount of space. I don't need Time Machine to back all those up because I can go back to iTunes and I can re-download that content. Same thing with my applications folder or my mobile applications. So what's great is you can go into your Time Machine settings, go into the system preferences, go into Time Machine, and go into the options, and you'll see a list that says exclude these items from backup. You click the little plus icon, and you can start to add volumes and folders and files, anything that you don't want Time Machine to back up, you can put in there. And I put those items in there, especially, like I said, for some of my external volumes. Something to note about that, and this happened to me recently because I bought a new hard drive. I needed a bigger storage device for my iTunes media. I had run out of space. So I bought a new drive. I moved everything over, and I had forgotten to go in and exclude the files like my podcasts from my Time Machine backup on the new volume. So I actually came back in the morning, looked at my Time Machine, and it had deleted a bunch of the archive stuff because it needed room to put those new files that it saw. It saw this new hard drive, new files, and back those up. And it did its thing. It backed those things up, but I had forgotten. So I lost a little bit of my Time Machine history. Not too much. It wasn't too bad. But if I had just remembered when I plugged in that new Time Machine drive, go back into your options and you're going to have to reset those exclusions. So make sure you do that. But definitely exclude anything that you're not going to want in your Time Machine backup. You don't need it backing up extra stuff. It takes extra time, stuff like that. So that is one thing that I absolutely do. I also turn on the checkbox that says Show Time Machine Status in the menu bar because I like to see what Time Machine is doing. I have noticed in certain situations when Time Machine is running in the background, it will slow my Mac down. Most specifically when I'm running Parallels, when I'm running any virtualization software and Time Machine kicks in, it bogs down my whole Mac. So sometimes I do like to turn off Time Machine, and I've gotten myself in trouble in these situations where I've forgotten to turn it back on. Well, if you have the icon in the menu bar, when you go into the Time Machine preferences and you slide Time Machine to off, the menu bar icon grays out, becomes gray, and that is a visual indicator that Time Machine isn't on and it isn't running. So now I try and remember to look up in the menu bar. I can see the Time Machine icon, and I know that if it's gray, then I have a problem. I need to go back and turn on Time Machine. Plus, it gives you a status when Time Machine's running. You can click on it. You can see how many files it's going through, how much it's backing up. So I do like to have that feature on. The other nice thing about having it up in the menu bar is that it gives you access to a couple of additional features. One, you can get quick access to the Time Machine preferences. You can also kick off a backup. So in those cases where I've shut it off to do some work and I want to turn it back on, but I want it to force the backup, I can say backup now. And then also, if you hold the option key down when you click that icon, you get a couple of additional options. One is says verify backups, and I didn't know what this was. This feature is actually specifically if you have a time capsule. You can actually have Time Machine verify your time capsule backups and make sure that they're okay. I guess in the past there's been some issues with that, and you might need to rebuild your time capsule Time Machine backup, and that happens automatically. But if you wanted to do it manually, you can select that feature. But the other big one is browse other Time Machine disks. So if you get a new hard drive with Time Machine and you want to hold on to your old archive, you can keep that on the old drive. You could keep that old drive connected to your Mac. You can only have one Time Machine drive backing up. You can back up multiple Macs to it, multiple user accounts, but you really can only have one Time Machine drive hooked up to one Mac at a time. You could leave that old drive connected, and you can use that option to go back and browse. So when you select it, it'll bring up ability to go out and pick the old Time Machine volume or the old Time Machine backups folder, and then you can browse through that, and you can go back and recover and restore any files that might be in that history. So a couple of good extra features in there. And that's pretty much it. I mean, that's how I set up my Time Machine. It's pretty simple. And if you haven't done it, you know, I encourage you. Hard drives are really cheap. It's a really easy form of backup, and it really is nice for those, oops, I deleted that iPhoto file that I didn't want to delete that. I want that back. You can go back in time with Time Machine and get that very quickly and very easily. Now, all you do is launch iPhoto, go to that album that you deleted the file out of, activate Time Machine. You get the Time Machine view. You go back to the day when you know you had that photo. You select it. You hit restore, and zoom, all of a sudden, you're back up and running, and it works great. For finding email, how many times have you had it where someone said, I sent you that email, and you go, oh yeah, I bet they did, but I think I deleted it. Well, now you don't have to ask them to resend it. You could just go back and get it yourself. And then you look like the hero. You say, oh yeah, I have that email. No problem. I'll go get that. And they're none the wiser. So if you can't tell, I'm a big fan of Time Machine. That's just thought I'd share how I set mine up. All right, I'm excited about this next tip. It's an iPhoto 11 tip, and there's been something, this has been bugging me about, and I don't think it's just exclusive to iPhoto 11. I don't remember when this issue cropped up, and you've probably had it. I just find it completely infuriating, and I never went and researched it. It never bugged me enough, obviously, to go figure out what the problem was and see if I could fix it, but I received an email from David, and he prompted me to go looking for this because he said it was annoying him too to no end. And what I'm talking about is in iPhoto 11, at least, when you go to create a new album, so you say file, new album, whatever is currently selected in iPhoto will be automatically added to that new album. And oftentimes, I just want a new blank album. I don't want anything in there. I just want to create the album, and then I want to start adding stuff to it. But every time I would create a new album and there'd be like whatever photo I was selected on. And it gets worse because if you're just on your main library, you have the whole library selected. Suddenly you have an album with your entire iPhoto library in it, which is completely useless and annoying. So it works. It happens that way for events, whatever you have selected. And the same goes for the new create button. If you go down, at least with the create button that's in iPhoto 11 in the bottom toolbar, it will show you that it's going to create an album with X number of items. It lists the number of items. So when you see, oh, you want to create a new album with 452 items in it? You're like, no, that's not what I want. So turns out the fix is pretty easy. All you have to do is hold down the shift key. So if you grab that file menu and you go to new album, when you hold the shift key down, you'll notice that it changes to new empty album. The keyboard shortcut for it is command shift N. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to work when you're using that create button in the lower menu bar, but it does work beautifully for just creating a new blank album. And I think this is kind of becoming consistent because if I remember, I think GarageBand is the same thing. Command Shift N creates a new track that's just a new blank track. And it seems kind of similar to the change that Apple made back in the Finder. And that's another one I still haven't gotten used to. I still try to do Command N to create a new folder and it creates a new Finder window. And that one just drives me crazy. But the Shift key is the key. Holding down the shift key. So remember, hold down that shift key. And I guess that means Apple has shifted all of these things on us. I know, bad joke, but had to throw it in there. Anyway, thanks, David, for making me go find that. And I'm going to be a much happier camper when I'm making new albums in iPhoto now. I don't know about you, but I've often thought that the switch that Apple's making to touchscreen interfaces, while it's amazing and revolutionary and it's really great, and I guess this kind of goes to my concerns earlier about losing the physical home button on an iPhone or an iPad. Touch interfaces are great, but they're not great for everything. They don't work for every situation. We know that with iPhones, there's all these products now for if you live in a cold environment and you need to use the device and you wear gloves, well, the touchscreen doesn't work through your gloves and things like that. And I got this voicemail from Greg, and he kind of had a similar problem, and I wanted to help him out.
Hi, Adam. This is Greg Lane. I'm from Springfield, Missouri. I have a question. I have had an iPod Classic for several years. I'm a mail carrier, and I keep the iPod Classic in my pocket, and I liked it because I could just walking up on someone, they're outside and want to talk or something, I could just push the scroll wheel through my pocket, wouldn't even have to take it out or anything, to pause it. Well, it died, and I am currently using my daughter's iPod Touch. Well, that does not have that feature. I have to take it out of my pocket, wake it up, unlock it, and then pause it, and only have hit the top button and put it back asleep, put it back in my pocket, just to talk to someone. And sometimes they don't even say anything, and I'm just, okay, I've turned it off and turned it back on. Well, recently I got into the habit, I don't know where I do know, sometimes when I'm using the phone, when the phone's ringing, I don't have time to do all that and answer the phone at the same time. So what I've been doing is just pulling the earphone cable out, which pauses my podcast. And my question to you is that doing any harm to my iPod? Am I going to kill it somehow, short it out, or is it an okay thing to do? Thanks. Enjoy your show.
Okay, thanks, Greg. You know, I got your voicemail, and I wanted to share this with people because I think there's some things that Apple doesn't make really obvious. I have a couple solutions for you. One thing I want to point out is some people might not even know that with an iPhone, an iPod Touch, and I think the iPods as well, at least the current generation ones, if you're playing a track in the iPod app or just on the device, and you remove the headphone from the headphone jack, it does actually pause the music. And that's a feature. It's perfectly fine. I don't think you're going to damage anything. About the only thing I could think of is if you're doing it a lot, I don't know how many times a day you're actually doing it, One, you could put strain on maybe the headphone cable because you're pulling on the headphone cable. You know, make sure you're pulling on the physical jack part and not just pulling up on the cord itself, because you could damage the headphones. You are putting some strain, I would imagine, on the physical connector as you're pulling that in and out. So maybe you could possibly wear it out just by doing it a lot, but I don't think you're going to do any electronic damage. You're not going to short anything out by jamming the headphone in and out, except the one possible exception could be if you're in a climate where there's a lot of static electricity and you accidentally short something out. I don't know, you know, but it's a feature. It's meant to do that. I'm sure Apple tests for that. I really don't think that's going to be a problem. But you point out this issue of if it just had a physical button, if it just had something you could tap through your pocket, then you wouldn't even have to worry about any of this, right? Well, one thing you did say is that you were bringing it out and you were waking it up and having to do the slide to unlock feature. You may or may not be aware there's actually a feature on the iPod Touch and the iPhone where if you double tap, even when it's on the lock screen, you can bring up the iPod controls. And so you can get access to the volume, the forward, skip track forward, skip track back, and the play pause button. So that'll save you a step. You'll still have to pull it out of your pocket probably to see, to see the button. But you can double tap and then use that play pause button. The other option, and I think this is the better one for your situation, is that you can get headphones with inline controls. I know that the latest generation iPod Touch, I think because it has the FaceTime camera, has the headphones that have the little bump, the little clicker in them, that has the microphone also built into it, and you can access all your iPod controls from that. So just squeezing that little bump on there will actually play or pause the music. It also has volume up and volume down and skip track forward, which I think you double click on the top end of it, and it's a skip forward, double click on the bottom. I don't use those headphones, and I know they come with the latest models. I'm not sure if the model you have came with those earbuds. A lot of people don't like Apple's earbuds, so there are third-party companies like Griffin Technologies makes an adapter called the Smart Talk adapter that you can plug any headphones into, but adds the little controls, the little control clicker on the headphone cable, and that would be perfect in your situation because you wouldn't even have to take the device out of your pocket. If someone walked up to you, just squeeze that little thing, pauses the music, and you're good to go. The last thing that I thought about, since you have to replace your iPod and maybe you don't want to buy another classic, which can be a little bit expensive, the iPod Shuffle, the newest version, they brought the physical controls back onto the iPod Shuffle. So you could pick up an iPod Shuffle. I think they're like $50, 2 gigabytes of storage. Maybe that's not enough storage, but it sounds like you're mainly listening to podcasts when you're on your route. So that might be enough just to have a dedicated iPod Shuffle just for podcasts or just for doing your route. And then you're going to have the physical controls in that one. You could just clip to the outside of your clothing and have direct access to the controls on the device. So you got a couple different options there. Hopefully one of those helps you out. But I'm with you on, in not all situations are touchscreen controls the most ideal way to work with a device. And finally today, you may or may not be aware, if you're a MacCast member, you know this, but on a couple different MacCast member episodes, I've been doing a feature I'm calling What's in Your Dock. And I talked about the items that were in my dock, the applications that were in my dock, and why, and sort of how I have my dock organized and why I put things there, and some tips and tricks on using the dock. And then I did an episode recently with David Sparks from Mac Sparky and the Mac Power Users podcast, and he shared his dock with us. Well, got some feedback from Ken, who told me about a cool utility that he's been using called Deeper, piece of software from Titanium Software. These are the same folks that make Onyx, which is a great tool for troubleshooting your Mac. I've told you about it in the past. I use a program called Cocktail, but Onyx is free and does pretty much all the same things that Cocktail does. It's just a user interface difference that is the reason I'm a Cocktail user. But I'll have a link to Titanium Software in the show notes. But this little application called Deeper exposes a lot of the little terminal preference hacks that you can do for Mac OS X. The application I've used for this, I've talked about, is Secrets from Blacktree, and that has support for some third-party applications. The Deeper is a bit more focused on just the Mac OS X hacks, but has a really nice user interface for accessing them. So Ken told me about this, and one of the sections, one of the tabs in Deeper, it does a bunch of other stuff, but one of the tabs in Deeper allows you to insert invisible spacers into your dock. So one of the tips I had given is I like to organize my dock into kind of little categories. I have a little internet web category. I have a category that's like my address book and email. I have a category for my web development applications. I have a category for my podcast applications, and everything's kind of organized together. Well, with this, I'm able to now put little spacers, visual spacers, to kind of divide that stuff up a little more physically. And I have it logically broken up, and I know what it means, but now you can kind of physically see where those breaks and those applications are. And I thought that was a cool little thing, but Deeper does go deeper than just that in terms of what it can do with the dock. I'm not going to go into all the features, but I thought I'd highlight some of the things that it enables you to do with the dock. So I don't know if you know, if you've ever moved your dock to the left or right-hand side, and that's something that's in the built-in options. If you just right-click or control-click on that little divider that is between the applications on the left and the folders in the trash on the right, you can change the position of your dock, so from the bottom to the left or the right. Well, if you move it to the left or right, it doesn't have that visual 3D effect where it's kind of fading off into the horizon or acting like a little shelf. You get a 2D effect. Well, with Deeper, you can actually enable that 2D effect regardless of where the dock is. You can also change the minimizing effect. The defaults, I think, are Genie and a feature called Scale. There's also a hidden one called Suck. Such a bad name, but you can enable sucking in your dock. Yeah, you just what you want, your dock to suck. Also gives you the ability to change the positioning, not in terms of where it is, you know, left, right, or bottom, but also gives you the ability to change where it's anchored. And what I mean by anchored is typically, even though you can put the dock on the left of the screen or the right of the screen or the bottom of the screen, it's always centered. If you'd like to have it pushed to the left or pushed to the right, Deeper will allow you to change that setting also. It can let you turn off the graphic effects, so the core animation effects when you're opening an application, the bouncing of the dock when you have an alert in the background, you can turn that off. So if that annoys you, you can have it show you only the applications that are running. So normally when you have an application in the dock and it's running, you get that little blue dot by it. You could have it shrink your whole dock and only show you the applications that are running. You're going to lose the ability to actually see applications that are stored in your dock and launch them. But some people don't really use the dock. They launch applications another way, and maybe you just want the dock to show you running applications. You're able to do that. You can make, and this is a feature that I like and have enabled through secrets, is you can make any applications that you have hidden have transparent icons. So it's a little visual indicator of what applications that I have hidden in my dock. You can enable the automatic hiding and showing of the dock, which is a built-in feature. I'm not sure why you would want to do this, but you can disable the new expose menus. So if you click and hold an icon in the dock, you get the little expose menu. You can actually disable that feature. You can lock the size of the icons so that you can't, if you've ever accidentally hit that little spacer and drug up or down on the dock, you know that that allows you to change the size of the dock. You can lock it so that that can't happen. You can also lock the dock content so nothing can be accidentally added or removed from the dock. And then there's a couple of features that allow you to play around with the stacks. Those are the folders that are over on the right-hand side after the break and before the trash icon. You can turn off the hierarchical menu list if you use that feature. So when you click on applications folder, if you have it in the list view where you can actually drill down, if you don't want to have the drill downs, that was something that was added. So if you'd like to remove that, you can turn that off. You can, for the grid view, enable it so that when you mouse over an icon in the grid view, it gets highlighted. If you've ever used the keyboard controls with the dock, you'll notice when you keyboard over something, using the arrow keys in the grid view, you actually get a little highlighting over it. You can have that actually happen on mouse over. And then something that I like is there's these extra folders that you can add to, or stacks that you can add to that part of the dock for recent items, favorite network places, favorite folder shortcuts that you've saved. You can actually add folders for those or little stacks for those, and that can be enabled through the application. And then finally, the ability to add those spacers to the dock. So all of that stuff just in one tab of Deeper. They also have all kinds of settings for the Finder and the Safari and Mail.app and iTunes and all that stuff. So check it out. I'll have links to it in the show notes. And a big thank you to Ken for sharing that application with us, because I didn't realize those guys made that app. And so it's a nice little app, and I have it installed in my utilities folder now. So thank you, Ken. That's going to do it for today. I want to thank all of my show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software and get trials over at circusponies.com. Smile, they make Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label. You can check out their stuff and get demos over at smilesoftware.com. And Phoronix, head to phoronix.com and check out Deep Freeze and PowerSave Mac. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support. If you have any feedback for me, anything you want to let me know about, a great piece of software like Ken told me about, you can send your email to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave voicemail there. And if you do, if you could leave your email address and spell it out for me, that's greatly appreciated. If you'd like to save on long distance charges, maybe you're in another country, you can also leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast. And if you need links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode, including that link to that Deeper software, or information on maybe the Griffin Technology Smart Talk adapter for your iPhone or iPod Touch, you can find all of that at the maccast.com website. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum. Forum.maccast.com is the URL for that. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or on Facebook, facebook.com/themaccast. And if you'd like to hear what's in my dock or get some extra content from the MacCast, be sure to check out the MacCast member program. That's at member.maccast.com. For as little as $4 a month, you can sign up and get extra episodes each and every week. I'm still looking for new music, so if you know somebody who's in a band who wants to get some exposure for their stuff, please have them send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. We play new music tracks, have been on every episode since the beginning of the MacCast, or most episodes. Occasionally we have to skip it. This time around, I guess I'm going to turn into the vault and bring out something that I played years ago. It came from the PodSafe Music Network at the time. It's now called Music Alley, musicalley.com. But the track is called Shine by Kevin Reeves. Enjoy, and I will see you all next time.
So dead inside, I count to 10, but I can't find out where I hide. I need a remedy from this calamity. Somebody tell me if I'm why I just can't find the rhyme. Oh, I know something's gotta give. Something deep down inside of me that's been dying just to live. Well, I feel it underneath my skin. There ain't no way in hell I'm ever giving in. Time. I'm waiting for the day when